One day he got a letter in the mail from his cousin from back in Manhattan, Kansas, dad's hometown, and it was a funeral announcement of one of his close cousins had died. And he was the first black mayor of Manhattan, Kansas, where Kansas State University, Merd Hanks Jr., deceased. So that just started me on this quest. I wanted to know just my my relatives on my father's side. I never met his parents. They passed away before I was born. He had a brother. He passed away when I was 1 month old. So I never did connect it, my dad's family. So that's kind of how the project started out in 1989, just trying to learn about his people. And as the more I kept digging, the more I kept going further, and I was saying, wow, if I keep doing this, I may be able to go, who knows how far back I can go. So that's how it got started.
Okay, our third co-host is joining us.
Good morning. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, and I'm glad to be here.
It was just one of those days, yes. More rain than usual.
Wow, this is a very interesting episode in your life. You worked on this for quite a while. Now, what prompted you to get interested in this particular area?
Well, as you know, Obi, and we met for the first time several years back at a genealogy, I think it was a seminar or conference for the Genealogical Forum of Oregon. And, I just wanted to just know about my relatives. That's basically what it was. I knew a lot about my mother's side of the family. I had cousins here in Portland, Oregon, but never connected with my folks on my dad's side. So that's how it got started. And then, of course, the movie Roots and of course, the book, that also kind of fueled my interest too. Just wanting to connect with your family, knowing the roots, and I love history. And so as I started going into it, I went up to the Seattle National Archives in Seattle, started looking up the census records, just basic tools that most genealogists use, the census records, deeds, tax records, that sort of thing. And the more I kept digging, I discovered that my family had moved to Kansas from Mississippi. But I didn't know where in Mississippi. But apparently they had migrated to Kansas in 1879 on one of the great migrations of American history. A lot of people probably haven't heard of the Exodus of 1879 is what they used to call it. And it was a migration where many African Americans were leaving the South and heading to the land of Kansas, and my great grandparents were on that. Records. His name was Richard Eskridge, a man that was born in South Carolina in 1775, and he came out to Mississippi in 1834 with property and money and human beings as embodied, as slaves. And so he died in 1860, and So I was able to connect with some of his living relatives, and they were able to open up a door to me. I even was able to go back and meet them face to face, and they showed me the family cemetery, the family grounds where the house used to be. The house had burned down, but I'll never forget that trip, 1994, and that was a turning point in my search.
So is that where, when you were able to look at the records they kept of the slaves, is that how you found out what country in Africa your ancestors came from?
You know, it's very interesting how that developed. I started, after I located my great-great-grandmother, identified her through the help of the relatives of Richard Eskridge, I started to realize that, and this is something that most African-American genealogists find out, is that a lot of slaves were inherited in the family, and they were bequeathed or handed down to grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. So I just kind of followed the paper trail. So like I mentioned, Richard Eskridge, he was born in South Carolina in 1775. Well, logically, I wanted to find out, well, who was his father? And his name was Burdett Eskridge, born in Westmoreland County, Virginia. And that's where a lot of the records turned up. I was able to locate probate records. And, of course, in probate records, they do an inventory of all of the deceased person's property, right? So for African Americans, back during the time of slavery, you know, African Americans were considered property, unfortunately. But for a genealogist, that's a gold mine, because I was able to find, the further I went back in time, I was starting to notice African names that were listed on the inventory. And that held true in my case. There was one African name that kind of jumped out on me, and the name was Akey, but it was spelled, it was anglicized, it was spelled A-K-E-Y. And I noticed that that particular slave, I couldn't tell if it was male or female. I thought maybe it was female because it was listed next to other female names. But it passed from George Eskridge to his son Samuel Eskridge, Westmoreland County, Virginia, and then passed on to Burdett Eskridge, the one who ended up moving to South Carolina. So I followed this trail, and that's how I discovered that that was my fifth great. Well, I thought it was a female. Later, I discovered that it was a male, and that's what prompted me to write this the second edition to the book. I had written one prior in 2005, but found out that he was a male, actually. So doing the research on the name, Akey, it's a fruit tree in West Africa that was brought over on the slave ships to Jamaica. And the Webster's International Dictionary even has this in their dictionary. It comes from a language called Kru, K-R-U, which is a tribe that primarily live in the area around Liberia and the Ivory Coast.
So it's Akey. You know, it's interesting. All these years, I have seen that and thought it was Akey. Okay, so I'm glad that you're here to clarify that. You know what strikes me? Unfortunately, because of slavery and just other trials that African Americans in this country have faced, that many of us don't know our families, that we're spread apart, and thanks to Roots, we you know, we're trying to fight our way back and research our way back and find each other. I remember going to a wedding and seeing all these attractive men and thinking, good gravy, these are my cousins. I could have married one of these people. I wouldn't have known. You know, it's that kind of things in a very basic, real-life kind of a way. There's so many things that we lose. You know, there's so many dangers because we don't know who we are. But I want you to I want you to say a little bit more before you continue about the Exodus of 1879, because as you said, many of us don't know anything about that. So could you just say just a little bit more about that?
Yes, and thank you. There was a great writer by the name of Nell Irvin Painter, and mm-hmm. she wrote a great book about it. If anyone has not read her book, it came out in, I believe, 1978 and was kind of like a commemoration of it. Please get it. It's available at the library. Most, I'm sure, libraries will have that. But due to the racism and the bigotry that was going on after the Civil War ended, and the Confederacy, you know, broke down, you know, African Americans were now free people. And, of course, with the passage of the 13th Amendment, they became U.S. citizens. But they still had problems during that Reconstruction time period. As we know, there was many atrocities committed toward African Americans. They were still being held down, kept in their place, not able to, and land was the thing. You know, if a person could own land, they could actually, you know, mobilize in society. But for African Americans, so many hurdles. So it got to the point, at least I know in Mississippi, where there was many people killed for trying to, you know, better their family, better their life. So many of them just decided they wanted to leave. And in 1877, some had gone to Kansas and came back saying that there's land available, the land is free. Of course, it really wasn't free, but kind of rumors just kind of spread about this, and it just kind of took off like wildfire. Pretty soon, word was spreading through Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, Louisiana. I think there was a few other states that were involved in the exodus, and just all of a sudden, in between 1879 and 1880, people were just leaving the South, and it was just kind of a word of mouth thing that they wanted to just go to Kansas, that there was land waiting for them, they could start new lives, and that's how it kind of went. And so my great grandparents, William and Rosetta Hanks, they got on the Exodus too with their, at the time they had four children. And Susie, James, Clifford, and Maria, and they trekked on there. I don't know how they got to Kansas. I'm thinking they may have taken rail train, because there was a newspaper clipping that I found in one of the Kansas newspapers dated 1879 that thousands of African Americans came in on the rail cars, and the farmers in Kansas were. The governor of Kansas didn't even know that this was going to happen. It just hit them all of a sudden, all these people coming, kind of like what happened during World War II, when many African Americans came, you know, to Portland, working in the shipyards.
And all across the country. Thank you.
Exactly.
If you've just joined us, you are listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO Portland. We are speaking with Stephen Hanks, the author of The Aki Tree, which is a genealogical study of his family.
So after you found out the country in Africa where your forebears were from, did you go there?
Yes, I did. 1999, my wife and I had the privilege to, we wanted to go to Liberia originally, but at that time, if you remember, there was a lot of instability still going on in Liberia. It was not a good idea. There was still some fighting going on between, you know, different packets of rebel soldiers and the government, and so we kind of had to scrap our plans to go to Liberia. But so we decided instead to go to the Ivory Coast. So we left. We actually were planning to go in December. We were going to leave the last week of December and the first week of January of 2000. So, you know, I had like a 2-week vacation, got the time off, was ready to go, and was getting ready to make my travel plans. But then I looked at the prices, and I said, well, no, there's no way I could afford that. So my travel agent said, well, there's a good price in November. Why don't you go in November? And it's a good thing that we didn't go in December. I'll tell you that in a minute. So we went in November. We're able to meet various ones of that tribe in the capital of Ivory Coast, capital called Abidjan. And we had a great time there. It was truly was a cultural shock, to say the least. The country spoke French, but then they also spoke their tribal languages too, and it was quite something. But when we got back home to the States, the very next month, December 25th, they had a military coup in Ivory Coast for the first time ever in the country's history. Prior to that, Ivory Coast was called the Paris of Africa. It was very peaceful, stable, financially stable country, but December 25th, they have a military coup, and so it's a good thing we didn't leave in December like we were planning to.
So while you were there, did you see family resemblances?
Not really family resemblances, and I should kind of, you know, when I say that I was able to identify the identity or the ethnicity of this African woman who was on this inventory record of George Eskridge, slaveholder in Westmoreland County, Virginia, in the year 1736, I was able to identify, you know, her ethnicity, that she came from this tribe called Crew, based on her name. And there were other slaves I also noticed on this plantation of Virginia that also possibly came from Liberia, because some of their names were very similar to names that are in that tribe. But I could not find a direct link to, she was just a member of that tribe, but as far as who her people were, you know, that would be a dream if I could go even further back, but I wasn't able to. So as far as resemblances, I can't really say that, although one did look like my mother, but that's on my mother's side, so that's going to be my next book. I'm going to write something about her side of the family, but it was definitely amazing to just be back there and connect on that level. Definitely
talking about connections, did you experience a spiritual dimension in your quest and search for your ancestors?
You know, that's a good question, and I can say that I have some very interesting highs and lows, and I can remember one time where I found a deed, speaking about the Burdett Eskridge that I mentioned, that left Virginia and took his family to South Carolina and took a Key's daughter with them. The daughter's name was Jenny, which ended up being my line. It went from a Key to Jenny to, they had a daughter named Rose. Rose had a daughter named Eliza, which was my great-great-grandmother, and then Eliza gave birth to William, which was my great-grandfather, and he took the name Hanks. So the family name was actually Eskridge, and then it changed to Hanks, and then that's the family that came out to Kansas. But I remember coming across a slave deed dated 1793, where Jenny, the daughter of the Key, she was sold off, and it just hit me like a lightning bolt. I mean, talking about spiritual dimension, that was a spiritual dimension there, because I just, you know, I kind of just got a little bit emotional there, and you know, because this was family, and she was sold off. Believe it or not, she was sold to a Baptist minister in Georgia. If you can imagine that, it said it. So, and I never did. Could find that whatever happened to her after that. She was sold in 1793. But yeah, there was a lot of spiritual dimensions on this journey, for sure.
You know,
definitely.
I'm wondering about, you seem to have the heart of a researcher. Did you do a lot of training, or was this all self-taught? How does that work? Because I know that there are people who do, you know, take classes, pay a lot of money to learn how to be a family genealogist. Was that the case for you?
That's a good question. I just kind of came natural for me. I didn't take any classes, any courses, or study. I did look up some how-to books on it at the library, and got, you know, just on conventional tools that most genealogists use. So I started with the census records, and then I started typing letters to the vital statistics in various cities states like Kansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, getting death certificates, newspaper obituaries. And of course, I started right with my own records right within my parents' house, because they had tons of books and stacks of boxes up in the closet of family information. So I started that first, and then from there, just following the paper trail. And one thing that I learned from the books that I did read was they always had a rule to work with what you already know and work your way back. Don't go your way back and try to come up to the present. It doesn't work that way. But just start with what you know and just work your way back methodically. And so I just kind of just, you know, learned through trial and error, basically. And I had no idea that I'd go all the way back to the 1700s. No idea at all. I just started off, you know, like I said, I just wanted to know about my relatives, my cousins on my dad's side, and had no idea that I'd end up, you know, going as far as I did.
The pictures you use in the book, where did the pictures come from? Did you already have them in the family?
Some of the pictures were in the family, and then some I got from cousins that I met along the way. And then some were even pictures that were given to me by the white descendants of the slave owner. Like I mentioned, when I went back to Mississippi in 1994 and I met the relatives of Richard Eskridge, descendants of him, and there was a 75-year-old woman by the name of C. Swanson, and she's now deceased, but she later, we kept in touch, and I'm still in touch with her daughter and husband, by the way, to this day, and even some others have come forward since the book and have contacted me, and we've been in touch. It's just really been amazing, the white side of the family, and I've even invited them to, we're going to have a family reunion in Duck Hill, Mississippi this August, and I've invited them to come if any of them would like to, and I sure hope they come. So some of them sent me some pictures too, quite amazing.
To sum this up, how did you go about finding a publisher, or was it self-published?
Yes, good question. Well, my first edition was self-published. I tried so hard to find a publisher and was writing letters to agents and, you know, would you take on this work? I would send them the outline, and then I'd send them the manuscripts, and it just wasn't getting anywhere, so I decided, let me just go ahead and self-publish, and that was in the year 2005. And I made a lot of mistakes. I learned a lot of lessons by doing it that way, but it worked out okay. But when I started finding all this new information, I said, I need to write a second edition of this, so I started writing. Finally, I got the manuscript together, and a lady by the name of Mrs. Wolf, and I believe she was in the New York area, she was related to the Eskridges, and she says that I know of an editor that would be interested in your work, and his name is David Kane. He's the editor of this publishing press called American History Press.
Yes.
And so she got me in touch with him, and I sent him the outline, sent him the manuscript, and he just took it right on.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. And he was a genealogist, too, so it worked out really nice.
Well, you know, we really appreciate you taking the time to tell us about your book. We certainly do recommend it to anybody out there who's interested in starting the path. This is Patricia Welch saying thank you all for listening to the March edition of Black Book Talk.
This is Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman, saying see you next month.
And O.B. Hill, bye-bye.
All right, good reading.
It's time for the KBOO News headlines at noon for March 6, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount. In the Upper Klamath region of Oregon, negotiations about water rights between ranchers and the tribes of the Upper Klamath ended Wednesday. Ranchers and tribes will have to vote to firm up the results of the adjudication process regarding the Sycan, Wood, and Williamson's rivers. Once they do, federal legislation to authorize the removal of four hydroelectric dams and to create an irrigation plan that will help ranchers can move forward. In the past, ranchers have relied on tribal waters to water their cattle during harsh droughts. Last summer, the tribes of the Upper Klamath exercised their water rights by shutting down irrigation systems when the water levels became too low to support the suckerfish that the tribes require. Federal legislation will help the ranchers who will have to fence their cattle off of the protected waterways, and some of the money will go to replanting trees to reduce the ambient temperature around the waterways. In the United Kingdom, anti-fracking protesters in Barton Moss, which is in Manchester, who are camping out on a proposed fracking site, have challenged their imminent eviction in court. The owner of the area, Peel Investments, also owns a grip of prime real estate in the northwest part of England, including the Manchester Shipping Canals. Exploratory drilling has been carrying on since December, despite the best efforts of the Barton Moss Community Protection Camp, or BMCPC, who have been using their bodies to block equipment. Activist co-defendants include a former oil field executive and a former infantry officer. They appeared at the Civil Justice Center in Manchester, asserting that their human rights would be violated on three counts: the right to a home, the right to expression, and the right to pedestrian use of walkways. The walkway leading up to the site has been used by protesters who walk slowly in front of the trucks of IGAS, the company owned by Peel, preventing their access to the site. Various implements were strategically abandoned in front of the access road, including a wind turbine blade. A biorefinery near Kletskanie reinvented itself after the initial business plan of turning corn into ethanol didn't pan out. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality allowed the Columbia Pacific Biorefinery to begin moving dirty crude oil from trains coming from North Dakota onto barges in the Columbia. The DEQ said that air quality wouldn't be affected by the switch. North Dakota crude on a train killed 47 people in Quebec last year. Long trains with over 100 cars currently run through Rainier, Scappoose, and St. Helens. The oil goes along the BNSF line through Vancouver, Washington, and crosses into Oregon shortly after that. The Union Pacific line brings crude from Utah and Canada as well. The officials of these small towns had no warning or input about the oil trains moving through their communities. And now the DEQ says that the Columbia Pacific Biorefinery is violating their permit because they removed over 150 million more gallons of oil than they were supposed to. And that perhaps an ethanol plant should never have been permitted to run petroleum in the first place. Alarmingly, the permit they need to continue to operate will allow them to move almost 2 billion gallons a year, the equivalent of 38 trains a month, before needing permission from the Port of St. Helens. On April 3rd, a public hearing at Kletskanie High School will begin at 6 p.m. To make a comment via email, contact NWRAQ. Permits at deq.state.or.us. Questionable decisions by British Petroleum have been revealed with the annual report released today. BP executive Bob Dudley's take-home increased from 2.6 to 8.7 million. Dudley's bonuses, salary, and pension contributions and shares brought him to over $13 million for 2013. British Petroleum, in addition to being on trial for gross negligence in the United States regarding the horrific Deepwater Horizon spill, also took out a 20% stake in the Russian state-owned oil company Rosneft. That's it for the Oil and Water Noon Headlines today. Please tune in every single weekday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news brought to you by dedicated volunteers in our Southeast Portland studios.
And you're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis, and our translators at K220HR Hood River, K282BH in Philomath. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.